You are here, and I'm your host, Brian Beatty. Thanks for listening to the podcast. It's the March 2013 edition, and if you believe in calendars, you might think that March, any year, would represent the start of spring. But apparently not March 2013 and not in Minnesota. This year we are still in the throes of one of those classic Minnesota winters, and I'll be honest, I am not cut out for them. I grew up in Indiana, southern Indiana, and March, to me, has always meant basketball, which I also was not cut out for. See, I was a tall, lanky kid after age 13. After some baby fat I had been carrying around since birth got absorbed in a growth spurt, and I shot over 6 foot tall. And it was expected of me and boys my size that we play junior high and high school basketball and make our communities and our families proud. But I had no interest in that. I preferred to sit around reading Kurt Vonnegut novels and practicing my saxophone a couple hours every day, much to the annoyance of the neighbor dog. And now I'm middle-aged and overweight, and people just assume when they look at me because of my size that surely I played football in junior high and high school, which is also wrong. So this is the most autobiography I've shared over the course of the entire run of the podcast, and there is a reason. Because up to now, we have neglected memoir and autobiography as a genre. And this month, we're remedying that with a piece by Jan Pettit, a piece called Idle Hands Can Unsaddle a Mind.
Don't eat the chicken, my grandfather whispered in a sly, conspiratorial way. My grandpa was a prankster. Come, I whispered back. I checked the cold drumstick in my hand to make sure I hadn't been slipped a plastic replica, a favorite trick of my brother's. But the drumstick was real, our standard fried the night before chicken for picnics, packed in a deep, square Tupperware. We were having a family picnic, far from home. It's been poisoned. They've poisoned it. Who's poisoned it, Grandpa? I wasn't sure where he was going with this. Usually my grandfather's pranks led to a punchline, a joke on my grandmother, a purloined treat, a quarter snagged from behind an ear. When things got dull, when adults began to drone in their tedious way, he'd catch my eye, pop his false teeth out, suspend them in front of his face for a ghoulish moment, and return them before anyone else saw. At my giggle, the whole room would turn to me and frown. Frowning was the highest praise, the hoped-for response to unbidden laughter. Around my grandfather, we were on high alert for fun, our lips curled up on one side, half prepared for the coming smile. In his presence, everything was funny, even the things that weren't. I was waiting for the joke. Who poisoned the chicken, Grandpa? My grandmother was my mother's sous chef, except she worked in her own kitchen. If the chicken were poisoned, then the answer had to be Grandma in the kitchen with the arsenic. But now I saw my grandfather wasn't joking. There was something off about his face. No hint of a smile. I went to the source. Grandma, is there anything wrong with the chicken? Grandpa says it's poison. The women exchanged a glance. My mother and grandmother knew each other so well, they barely had to speak. Their silence was filled with words nobody else could hear. Both of them looked over at my grandfather, who was sitting alone now. So, can I eat it or not? It smells fine. But the focus had shifted from food to Grandpa. My mother and grandmother moved the way teachers do at recess, converging on the child accused of some heinous misconduct, like throwing spitballs or looking up a girl's dress. I had tattled without realizing it. My grandfather was in trouble. I should have eaten the chicken. The picnic was over. We had driven forever to get to this 4-star picnic place, and now we were leaving. Such a pearl was hard to find, the park that met the adult standards for shade and flush toilets, and our criteria for playground excellence. The horses on bouncy springs looked at us with surprise and longing. Not one ride before you go? The giant slide had gone unslid. The tetherball slumped on its rope, disappointed. My grandfather was guided toward the car as if he might bolt, as if he might transform from a slow, arthritic man into an antelope and leap into the forest. I half wished he could. He leered at me over his shoulder. Was he accusing me or sending me a warning? Then it was morning, back at home. My mother sitting at the edge of my bed. Honey, Gramps in the hospital. When she used the word honey, something was really wrong. A pet had been run over, or Santa was revealed as a myth. Nothing good came from the word honey. Because of the poison chicken? No, she told me. Grandpa's mind was playing tricks on him. The doctors are going to run some electricity through his brain and restart it. My mother must have heard incorrectly. Electricity was dangerous. You'd sizzle and fry if the radio fell into the bathtub. We knew these sorts of facts and pondered their less lethal cousins daily. So what if you dropped like a D-cell battery in the tub? Only a whack doctor like Frankenstein would electrify someone's brain. A few days later, we drove to Beatrice, the nearest town with a hospital, to see Grandpa. My mother told us to wait outside and look right up there. She'd bring him to the window. Eventually, an old man appeared. It wasn't my grandfather. The man framed in the sky was wearing a gaping dress. You could see his chickeny legs. My grandfather wore overalls, except on Sundays when he put on regular pants. I'd never seen his legs. The man in the dress looked like a clown, except he wasn't smiling. My brother and I waved like crazy, in case we were wrong and it was our grandfather. Whoever he was, he could use some cheering up. From two stories down, the man's face appeared stretched out and sad. A pulled taffy face. If that's Grandpa, I thought, they have accidentally taken out his brain. When my grandfather came home, he was different. He had forgotten his brief visit to lunacy, had forgotten the poisoned chicken, had forgotten that he'd locked my grandmother in the house and stood at the window with a shotgun to protect her from the killers and rapists on the loose in Wymore. Luckily, he'd recognized the ambulance driver, a guy from down the street, and hadn't shot him. All of this had taken place after our picnic, details I learned years later. Grandpa was quiet now, and he seldom smiled. He didn't even seem to know that adults were supposed to smile at children. There were new lines in his face, unhappy lines. He looked at us like we were people he should recognize, but didn't. My mother said it would take time. He's healing, she told us. How did she know what was going on behind the fence of his skull? Which riverbank his brain was headed toward? If you had gone insane, could you go sane? I knew what caused the nervous breakdown, as it was described, and always in very hushed tones. Grandpa had lost his job. When my grandmother ran the Good Samaritan home, Wymore's old folks' home, Grandpa was the janitor and fix-it man. But she'd retired, and the new crew had other ideas. They didn't agree with my grandfather's unorthodox ways, fixing things by sense instead of protocol. And so he wandered around until he lost his mind. If the lack of busyness had broken him, logic said busyness might fix him. So Grandpa was assigned tasks to keep him from slipping downhill. Tasks as a kind of handbrake. Sometimes we were his assignments, or he was ours. When my grandmother and mother went shopping together, they left the two of us home together. Who was babysitting whom? There was nothing for us to do. He sat in his big chair and sat. They got him a tiny electric organ, another assignment. The organ could play itself, even if the organist didn't feel like playing, and mostly he didn't. But even the upbeat tunes had Dracula-sounding overtones. I wasn't sure this was such a good thing. Grandpa had a guitar, too, with thick steel strings. He strummed it occasionally with one long, curly thumbnail. His hands didn't look like they knew how to work anymore. Once I found a stuffed panda bear in his bedroom, his own toy from childhood. I made it dance and talk to him. Finally, a tree saved my grandfather. Someone in Wymore cut down a cedar tree and gave it to him. Like a magician moving in slow motion, my grandfather made that tree disappear, one cedar plank at a time. He started simply, a cedar candle holder, a cedar bowl. Before long, our walls and shelves filled with his cedar distractions. He shaped key hangers, mirrored plaques, grocery list holders, nameplates that distinguished the little boy's room from her kitchen. How had we ever found our way around the house before? He built crushes and coasters, decorative wagons and doll-sized rockers. Knickknacks and gadgets poured out of him in an endless, earnest stream. The Cedar Projects became a kind of WPA for my grandfather, work invented to keep him sane. His creations found their ways into homes across Wymore. Bits of my grandfather's returning lucidity spread to the wind. It was no wonder my parents were always inventing jobs for me to do. I was beginning to understand. Normalcy was held in place by hard work. It was pinned together with tasks. This was, apparently, why our list of chores was longer than we could ever accomplish, why I was required to do the most loathsome jobs, picking up walnuts or sweeping the garage or stemming the strawberries, why all of us were loaded up like pack mules. The houses of Wymore were wooden precisely because they required so much maintenance. Scraping and painting were necessary for the occupants. Work anchored people to the ground, kept their heads from drifting away like unmoored balloons. The mind's connection to reality was fragile as a kite string. You daresn't let that kite fly. It could tangle in a tree. Idle hands could unsaddle a mind, and a mind could go anywhere. My grandfather was proof.
Jan Pettit is an advertising copywriter by day and a writer by night. On behalf of her, myself, and everybody involved, thanks for listening. And if you want to know more about the podcast, submission guidelines, etc., check out mnartist.org. Past editions are also available on iTunes. And we are on Facebook, so friend us if you're so inclined. And as always, I would be remiss if I didn't remind you to write, record, submit. You Are Here is a monthly literary podcast production of mnartist.org. mnartist.org is a joint project of the Walker Arts Center and the McKnight Foundation. The mission of mnartist.org is to improve the lives of Minnesota artists and provide access to and engagement with Minnesota's arts culture.